Richard, let's begin with the Preludes of Debussy. We talked 2 years ago about the Preludes, Book One. He wrote two books of 12 preludes each, the first between 1909 and 1910, and the second between 1912 and 1913. When we talked before, you were particularly drawn to the first book, and I think you said less so to the second book. So tomorrow at Davies, you're playing the second book of Debussy Preludes. What changed your mind?
The music. I just took a closer look, and they're enchanting, like the first book. A little different, maybe even a little more adventurous in certain ways. And also, the experience of playing the book as a whole, somehow, as in the first book, the preludes, beautiful as they are, one by one, make even more sense as a group. And some of the funny ones in the second book only really become totally right in context of the book as a whole. The juxtapositions are part of what makes it wonderful, I think.
Did Debussy mean them to be heard as a complete set?
That's a good question. I don't think he did, although I don't think he would have objected. He himself was very shy, as you know, about playing in public, and was very critical of his own playing, and also very critical of everybody else's playing. And we have the few occasions where he played the pieces in public, he played a handful from either book, or even mixed them up. But he arranged them carefully. The arrangement can't be an accident. He was very careful about everything he put out. And from the juxtapositions and from some of the evocations of previous preludes and the transitions, I think we can say that this ordering of the preludes is absolutely intentional. And both books make perfect sense as played as whole sequences.
Let's begin with number one. What is that edition you use?
This is the fairly new Durand edition.
Different from the old one?
Well, some things are different. Some notes are different. Oh. Some phrasing dynamics. The editor, one of the editors is Roy Howitt, who was actually a friend of mine, and a terrific scholar of French piano music in particular. He's also a pianist, which makes a difference. And he's published a book about Debussy called Debussy in Proportion, about Debussy's working methods, and particularly his youth of Fibonacci series and Golden Mean, these rather secret things that Debussy did, but we don't really have to know about, but it's interesting. And but he's also, I see, in collaboration with Claude Helfer, well-known French pianist.
Oh, the French pianist.
Yeah, and so there are extensive notes. And some of the most interesting things are that Debussy made piano rolls of these pieces. I heard a few of them. They're hard, really, to imagine that he played that way. Piano rolls are notoriously difficult to make sound like a human being. And he did make some phonograph records. And when we hear those, you can hear a shadow anyway of what he must have been as a pianist. You can hear the sensitivity, which I think you can't on the piano rolls. But the interesting thing about the piano rolls is that they have different notes and different rhythms. And you can tell from the way the little metal plectra, whatever they are disposed on the rolls, that he had second thoughts. And Roy has put some of these into the edition. So you can make your choices, either what he published or what he eventually thought about doing that. If you think that these things are intentional, I think they seem to be.
Which side do you lean on? What he wrote or what he
I lean on the side that pleases me more, which are usually the later corrections, actually, I think are more interesting. Not in the second book, they didn't do that. He only recorded a few from the first book. There's one very important one, I think we might have talked about it, in the Gulf Cathedral, where in the printed version, suddenly a passage in half notes comes. And it's often played exactly as written, but it's clear that Debussy had in mind in this place, as in other places, that the half note is the previous metrical division. So it's actually, it should be twice as fast as it's written.
It's great that there are still controversies about music written 100 years ago.
Right.
So Briard is the first.
Yeah, it starts with Fog, which is what everybody thinks Debussy's music is, much of it. But in fact, it's a very carefully, this is one of the few pieces in which actually that mist is kind of sort of the subject matter of it. And in this case, the mist is two tonalities, one superimposed on the other. And he says in the beginning that the left hand, which is playing the tonal triads, should be a little bit more than the right hand, which is playing the Fog. I can't play as softly here as I'd like to. And so you have. To me, this sounds not only like mist or wood, if I could make it work here, but it sounds also a little bit like Petrushka. And I've always wondered about the mutual influence. You know, Stravinsky loved Debussy, and they met, and they played the first performance, the private performance of the Rite of Spring together. They played that four hands, which must have been one of those occasions you would like to be a fly on the wall.
Oh, there was a recording.
The two of
that.
Them there reading it together, or playing it together. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of incredible.
Is Petrushka's before this prelude?
Now, I think so. Uh-huh. I think it is, because I think the Rite of Spring was 1913.
Yeah.
And Petrushka was a few years before, and these preludes were written somewhere in between, but mostly in rather short stretch of time, in between the 12 and 13. And I just, you know, some of those, the circus sounds with the triads in Petrushka, of course Debussy could have come up with that himself, but I can't help thinking that he was very impressed by Stravinsky.
These pieces are full of pianissimos alternating with triple. And you're talking about how it's difficult to get control on different instruments. I'm surprised that, for instance, Walter Gieseking's recording you listen to, and it's not pianissimo at all. Or maybe I just have it turned up too loud or something. But,
or it could be that, you know, recorded very close to the mic and nothing sounds soft enough.
Exactly.
You know, they maybe didn't have the distancing required.
But how do you deal with that when right now we're in the green room of Davies Hall and you're on a new piano?
Well, I'm trying. Maybe if I had another half hour of this piano there, I might be able to do that's better. But you hear, now also there's a soft pedal on this piano which produces two notes at once, which gives even a more bitonal effect, multitonal. But notice it's the C and the D flat, C and the D flat here in the beginning, and later on it's the, again, I feel Petrushka chords. Both the semitonal things and the augmented fourth together. Again, a Petrushka thing, although something that a lot of other, again, so, you know, Debussy was, everybody says, is now maybe the first modern composer. And not less so because he's so wonderfully enjoyable to listen to. But you can hear, for example, this passage after the after this subsides, you have this. Now, I don't know if that recalls to you what it seems to me very much like what Bartok does in things like the Out-of-Door Suite. I would like to be able to play it now, but I can't. But very eerie, large spacing, extremes of the piano, and sort of layers of sound. And of course, we know that Bartók was another great admirer of Debussy. Met him and wanted to come, you know, come to Paris and meet him. I don't know if we mentioned that wonderful story about Bartók. And Bartók knew Philippe, Isidore Philippe, the great pianist. And he knew, and Philippe knew everybody in Paris, and wanted to introduce Bartók, who was then 20 years old, to Saint-Saëns, and anybody else he wanted to meet. And Bartók said, "I'm not interested in meeting Saint-Saëns." "But Saint-Saëns is such a great musician." "I'm not interested." Then he mentioned Vidor and Vierne and all these people who were around, and Bartók was not interested. And this, so who is this kid interested in? And Bartók said, "I want to meet Debussy." "But Debussy," Philippe said, "Debussy is a terrible man. He's a misanthrope. He doesn't like anybody. He's very rude. He'll just insult you. Do you want to be insulted by Debussy?" Bartók said, "Yes."
But they never met.
But they never met, unfortunately.
Happy Bartók's birthday.
Sorry?
Happy Bartók's birthday today.
Oh, wonderful.
So
when the bitonalism really bursts out in this passage. Mysterious fanfares, and then once again back to the misty places. So this kind of mysterious fanfare that comes out of nowhere is very, again, bitonal. So it's a very, it's a quiet piece on the whole, but it's this kind of mysteriousness out of which something suddenly emerges, and then it goes into the, really into the fog at the end, which it's slower and slower and more effaces itself. He says a lot of Debussy, like the extinguished, extinto. He likes the extinguished things. Or at one point he has more nothing, plus rien. He says, and this piece ends. It's presque plus rien, almost more nothing. Piece begins. So you see why one might want to play these two pieces together. You hear not all you hear. And the G, F form the bass of. Could bring it out, but I think what the ear takes in is that you have a whole tone, slow whole tone at the end of one piece, and then with wonderful chords. Beginning of the next piece, which is called Feuilles Mortes, Dead Leaves.
So you think that was intentional? Debussy really thought.
Also. The first piece, yes, I think so. The transition is too beautiful for it not to be intentional.
And you play them really without a break in between.
More or less. This kind of chord. So it's so beautiful that you have simple triads. There, and then you have that transformed into this very unsimple French chords. This piece always reminds me that there's a book by Marguerite Long at the piano with Debussy, and he said to her, apparently, that his music was not to be played with necessarily a light touch at all. Like he said, "Fauré, play lightly," he said. I'm not sure that that's true, but that's what he said. Like picking flowers, he said, "No, but my music must make the roots vibrate." And he had, apparently, the connotation of a very deep sound. you know, without any percussion.
Do you find that pianists over-pedal often? For instance, in the first one, you talk about fog and mystery, and maybe in the hopes that there will be more, convey more a sense of the fog, that they tend to sort of slam down the pedal?
I haven't heard pianists play this music very much. I've been a little bit keeping away since I've been playing it myself. I've actually gone the other way and not listened very much. I heard one old Gieseking recording. It's hard to tell. I think it's, you know, Chopin wrote all the pedal markings in his music, which is amazing. And every piece of Chopin I've ever seen has pedal markings by Chopin. And Debussy, maybe it's understandable, hardly wrote any. I think a few places he says pedal here because he wants to make sure that you keep the bass. But otherwise he left it up to us, which I think was very nice of him. Because he probably felt, well, pedaling is such a personal art and so unnotatable. I really can't presume. we know that he liked the playing of Ricardo Viñas, the famous Spanish pianist who premiered some of his pieces, and we have actually a couple of recordings. Have you heard of Puerto del Vino?
Yes.
And Poisson d'Or, which is beautiful.
Uh-huh. And Ravel dedicated his Oiseau Triste to him because of the set of Miroir. He said that was the least pianistic of the entire set. So he dedicated it to this great virtuoso pianist. Interesting.
But Viñas was apparently a master of pedaling. And there are quite a few places in Debussy where I don't think it's possible to realize the music properly without using the middle pedal. I don't think that Debussy himself liked it or used it, but maybe a couple of those places, because you know that he wants certain kinds of blur, and you know certainly that he wants certain kinds of clarity, and the whole question is, where does he want what, and what do you think is best for the music? Certain kinds of harmonic blur are obviously necessary and right, and you can tell a lot of them from the way the music is written, but others I think work against it. So, but your question, I don't know. I think it's part of the fun of working the music out to see just what kind of pedaling you use, which also would be affected by acoustics and piano. One thing that I should mention about this second book, which is different from the first book, is if you look at it, much of it is written on three staves. You know, and that's unusual. And I think it's a very attractive thing.
And it gives you that sense of multidimensionality, that there are several,
exactly,
sort of,
right,
several layers at
There's
once.
A lot going on. There's layers of, you know, when you see it like that, you can really see how important this voice is, because here it has a whole stave of its own. And then you get somehow a sense of levels of sound. It's somehow graphically much better representation of the music than it would be two staves.
I want to say I'm here with pianist Richard Good at the Green Room of Davies Hall, and he's playing tomorrow night in Davies a program of W.C. Preludes Book 2, Brahms, Bach, and Mozart. Thanks very much to Phil Perkins for engineering this interview, and thanks to Jonathan Doff, and they are making it possible to do this here at Davies Hall. We're on number two, Prelude Book 2, Feuille Mort. There are markings like un peu plus allant et plus mm-hmm. gravement expressif, a little more lively, and grave expression. How do you do both of those at the same
that's
time?
That's a good,
it seems,
good
the music
there.
Seems full of these kinds of contrasts or
Well, this what it comes out of is, say this. This is the more going, and now this is the deep. If you play this kind of sound, now this sound, deeper bass, and more expressive, and more. One is sort of. suspended emotion. This is active. I think in a way it makes sense. Yeah. And here comes a passage where you have the, well, you have so much going on at the same time. You can see why three staves might be necessary. You have the kind of the solo with the bass. It reminds you of the bass. It always sounds to me like a very icy upper reach of a French horn against this, which is written triple piano in the double. Again, polytonal. Fanfare of this relates a little bit to that other fanfare which I played before. Suddenness of that coming out of.
That's in the number one.
That's in the number one, yeah. Coming out of nowhere and coming back, going back to nothing. This is a piece that almost cries out for orchestral. In fact, I did orchestrate it.
You orchestrated?
Long time ago. Well, no, I went. It was as an orchestration assignment when I went to school, and I noticed that the English composer David Matthews, I think it's David Matthews, has orchestrated Debussy preludes. Of course, they are wonderfully orchestrated on the piano, but it'd be interesting to hear what they would sound like in the orchestra. So here's another example. We end with this beautiful far off. Distant slow fanfare and then we have, so we end on C sharp or D flat in the bass with the C sharp held over third piece. Tonal link between second and third piece. And also we have this wonderful interruption.
And that is La Puerta del Vino.
This is La Puerta del Vino.
Yes, Manuel de Falla sent Debussy a postcard, right?
Yeah.
From Spain.
Yeah.
And
it was a picture of the Alhambra, the famous, they called it the gate of wine. It was a meeting place for gypsies, apparently. And Debussy, I think, was only in Spain once. I don't know if he went after that, but certainly before that, he had only spent a little while in the town of San Sebastian, in the Basque country. But he loved Albanus. He loved Spanish folk music, flamenco, cantejondo. Those things he loved that.
And he wrote some great Spanish flavored pieces like La Soirée en Grenade.
La Grenade and Iberia.
And this one.
Fantastic. Yeah. And he said apparently when he saw the postcard, "I think I can do something with that." So he did. And this is very Debussyan, with brusque oppositions of extreme violence and passionate tenderness, is how he writes the beginning movement of the habanera. And the habanera rhythm, of course, is here to you, which continues throughout almost the whole piece in a very muffled way. Meanwhile, all kinds of things happen on top of it. After that opening, which is marked harshly, thank you. so forth. Yeah, you can hear, of course, the guitar being almost. You smite the guitar with something like that. And the melisma, the Moorish style. Debussy's, we forgot one Spanish piece, this Interrupted Serenade, which is again a guitar piece in the first book of the Preludes. Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting that these Spanish pieces are generally collage pieces. They're snatches of this, that, sometimes very, very abruptly juxtaposed, one thing after another, you know, like almost like a cubism thing. It's very, very, they're very vivid, and they require you to sort of turn on a dime. You know, in this one piece, you have very expressive, rubato, marked, passionately ironic, gracious, as well as all these wonderful outbursts far off. I think also maybe, as in the Soirée Nocturne, a lot of spatial effects, a lot of things receding into the distance, things here, snatches of song from afar, all these things worked into a few pages. It's really quite an amazing piece.
The titles are always at the end, Some people have said, is it a known fact that he named them after he wrote them, or how did that work?
I don't know when. We don't know when he named them, but the fact that he put them at the end so sort of indicate that he didn't, he oversaw, I think, every aspect of the printing of his music, including occasionally the covers, either choosing the cover for La Mer, for example, from Hokusai, or doing, I think, his cover himself for the Children's Corner Suite, and he wanted the type, everything the way he wanted, because he was, of course, profoundly visual. But at the end, the title of the Preludes is printed with a bracket, three dots, and then the title. And I don't know about how it feels to you, if you see La Puerta del Vino, the beginning of a piece, just like that, like the title, and then you see it at the end in brackets, almost apologetically, with three dots, doesn't it make a difference?
Well, of course, because if you see the title at the beginning, then it...
it's like the caption.
Then it makes you think of the piece in a particular way.
Yeah. You begin to feel that the title is somebody owns the piece. And, you know, the piece is the illustration of the title, which, you know, like in the pictures in an exhibition, which is, of course, that's the way it is. It is like that. But these, I think he wanted to make the suggestion. It's not possible to play the piece without thinking of the title, and they just seem absolutely right, and they, you know, they are intimately connected with the pieces, unlike, say, Chopin, who doesn't do that, and it's hard to imagine him doing that. But Debussy had a kind of oblique way of doing it at the end, as poetic and evocative rather than in your face.
What comes next?
Then we go to something quite different, and the title comes at the end. And it's in quotes, this one. The fairies are exquisite dancers. Les fées sont d'exquises danseuses. And it begins this very, as light as possible. And this is, for me, when I remember when we talked about the second book and I said I didn't, I think what I said is some of them didn't attract me or some of them I didn't understand.
About
this one I didn't
book.
Understand. When we were talking about the first book, I meant the second book. This is one I didn't understand. I got to really love. I didn't understand it because in a certain way, it's actually one of the most, one of the strangest of all. Because this was inspired, this is a very definite inspiration here of, it's a book that was given to Debussy's daughter, and the book was Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens. By the way, much of what we're talking about I could tell our listeners, if they're interested, much of it I learned a book called Images, The Piano Music of Claude Debussy, which you probably know too, by Paul Roberts, who is a pianist, and wrote a wonderful book about the influences on Debussy of visual arts, about the music, but also about Debussy, his relation with the symbolists, the impressionists, the poets and painters of his time, and how all influences combined in his music and how much his music is infused with the spirit of his time, the artistic atmosphere of his time. It's a wonderful book, I think, and a very musical sensibility informs the whole book. So anyway, I learned about much of this from his book. So Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens was a book by, of course, Barry, who wrote Peter Pan, but also wrote other things about Peter Pan. And this is a tale about what happens in Kensington Gardens after the lights out, after the park is locked, and then Peter Pan figure and all the myriad life that goes on after most human beings are gone, except there are children there, and it sounds like a very lovely book, and it was illustrated by the British illustrator Arthur Rackham, who I think we met in talking about the first book of Preludes. It was Arthur Rackham's illustrations for Midsummer Night's Dream that apparently inspired or had something to do with the Puck, the Dance of Puck. So Debussy loved this book, and there was an illustration which shows these little creatures dancing on a tightrope, a little spider string, a web, over a spider, you know, thread of silk suspended over a spider web. And I think two insects are playing clarinet and cello. And Peter Pan is there. And just to give you a little bit of the flavor of this book, which I think is, as Paul Roberts says, is a very Debussyan in its atmosphere and nature poetry. He says, I'll find it.
I also want to ask you about it being a piece you didn't understand, but then you grew to love it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very interesting idea. But first, maybe you
the quote
yeah.
is, I'll read what it says in the poem. The tale of a tiny boy living on an island of the Serpentine in London's Kensington Garden. Navigating the water in a bird's nest and communing with the fairies and the birds would have greatly appealed to an artist so at one with childhood. Debussy did write Children's Corner. And so able to recreate childlike fantasies in his mature art. In Barry's story, we read this arrestingly Debussyan account of Peter Pan as a musician. He made a pipe of reeds, and he used to sit by the shore of the island of an evening, practicing the sough of the wind and the ripple of the water, and catching handfuls of the shine of the moon. And he put them all in his pipe, and played them so beautifully that even the birds would deceive, and they would say to each other, was that a fish leaping in the water, or was it Peter playing leaping fish on his pipe? And sometimes he played the birth of birds, and then the mothers would turn around in their nests to see whether they had laid an egg. It's nice. And it really is, have you seen it in a way, because you could imagine one of the things that Debussy wanted to do was to do these wonderful things with music. Yeah. More than any other composer I can think of, he was a nature poet in that way. Not in a naturalistic way necessarily, but in a way that somehow the music was analogous to nature and inspired by it in a special way.
Do you think of those images in the music as you're playing this piece?
The fairies, I can't get the little dancing sprite-like creatures in the air out of my mind. That definitely I do.
Where are they in the music?
Well, I can't quite approximate them too well here, but the openings, which is so ambiguous tonally and so light and is quintuple, it's in no particular place in the tonal universe here. It's just leaping around somewhere And then you have this Mark Leggerissimo with a little kind of, again, a fanfare. Almost everything in it is as light as possible and as quivery as possible and as mostly anchored. You know, you hear shreds of tonality. It's an E flat somewhere or other, although it doesn't end in E flat, it ends in D flat, as a matter of fact. So, but the middle section is the one that puzzled me. The middle section begins like this. Which is very different in mood, very much more romantic, so you say. By the way, for me, I don't know how, if this makes you think of anything, that particular gesture, do you have any?
What is it from?
Well, I think.
I hear the
Chopin barcarolle. I hear the Chopin barcarolle. One of the reasons, because it comes off from this chord, and it's a, you know, comes off from this launching pad of the lower chord. And the other reason I think about it is that we know that Debussy loved this piece particularly. He spoke about it.
Of the Chopin barcarolle?
Yeah, he spoke about wearing out some of the notes on his piano playing this piece. And so I can't help feeling that anybody who played the barcarolle is reminded of that, not only by the sound, but also physically, when you go like this and this, and you go to the top chord like that.
You recorded the barcarolle. It's wonderful. And you play it often, and it's a piece that has inspired many literary responses by Nietzsche and André Gide, and a whole lot
is
of people
true?
Have written about the barcarolle.
I didn't know that. No,
so I didn't know that Debussy was among them also.
Yeah, well, he loved Chopin so much and learned so much from Chopin and about so many aspects of piano writing. And of course, the etudes come out of Chopin too. But the thing that puzzled me about this passage, which goes on for pages, is that the ideas didn't seem to have less connection with each other than any other passage in all of the preludes. And I wondered about it. I didn't see how they related to each other. And through playing and through just immersing myself in the sounds, I began to feel, I still don't quite understand their connection, but they sound wonderful to me. That is actually what happens with a lot of music.
You mean that this middle section is connected to the other sections of the piece? Or to the
itself, in itself. There's four pages of music, which were many ideas, and it seemed to be free associational. And I do think that one of the things that Debussy, I wouldn't say he introduced into music, but it happens a lot in his music and seems to be part of his vocabulary, is the kind of non sequitur. You know, it's a big question about music. Why does something follow something else? And certain composers, like Beethoven, have a kind of fantastic sense of convincing you that this must follow, even though Beethoven also, I think, later on in his music, has becomes interested, I think, in just how far he can go without any obvious connection.
We talked about that once in connection with Schubert and the non sequiturs in Schubert, and I remember you saying that's sort of the way human life is, that things happen unexpectedly and not necessarily, excuse me?
Stuff happens.
Not necessarily rationally, and that might apply to Debussy as
outburst,
well.
The outburst in, do we talk about maybe the outburst in the A major, the slow movement of this piece of, what happens, the storm in the middle of that completely.
Can you play a little bit of the storm part?
Well, not right now.
Okay.
You can't play a little bit of the storm anyway. But here you have one idea following another, and they're all very beautiful. All, perhaps it's just the airiness that inspired Debussy to write particularly ungrounded things. But there is one theme that comes through, which is this. Kind of a waltz. That does appear several times, and then is interrupted by this, which is marked sweetly and dreamily. That might suggest, somebody suggest that's a little reminiscence of Brahms' waltz. And the whole passage is absolutely ravishing, and a little less explicable even than most of Debussy. And it does remind me that he was an amazing improviser. We talked about this in Mary Garden's autobiography. She says she used to be a friend of Debussy's wife, Lily. They used to come over and they would have chat. And meanwhile, Debussy would be improvising in the background, completely oblivious of them. And she said, it's tantalizing, that the way he improvised was like nothing in his music and was even wilder and stranger and more unearthly. And she said that it was fantastic, unforgettable, but really not like anything she had ever heard. And unfortunately, she said she could think of nothing quite like it. I sometimes think of this in the piano music as being perhaps the closest to an improvisation, the middle section of this. And it ends, apparently this is a quote from Weber. I think Debussy liked very much. At the end, in the middle of all this, it comes this from Oberon. And then it ends this way. So this is a quote from the opera, kind of a fanfare, like transposed into the key of, key of sprightliness. Anyway, and so that ends in D flat, which is, again, seems to be the key of much of the music. And then we're on the heather.
And this is
Bruyère, not to be confused with Bruyère, uh-huh. which I often did. And this, to me, is like Debussy returning to the feeling of the girl with the flaxen hair, and with this. I think it comes as a relief after all this, in the air quality, to be grounded in A flat major.
And a real melody.
And a melody and all those things that we like. It's a beautiful piece. I think one of the things that's wonderful about Debussy is how unexpected some things are. In the middle section, he has a melody that goes like this. He marks it joyous, piano. That's very unusual, I think. Joyous, and it conveys a sense of sort of inner joy without anything being obvious about it. I think that's quite lovely. Again, ending in a way you would not expect, with this triplet figure transposed into the bass after you get. Up with a start with the next piece. So you have a triplet figure at the end of this and a little triplet fanfare at the beginning of the next piece.
And this is General Levine Eccentric.
General Levine Eccentric.
Who is General Levine?
General Levine was an American vaudeville entertainer named Edward Levine, and he to judge from the picture, was truly eccentric. He outfitted himself in what looks like a combination of a soldier's costume and a clown's costume. Here he is. Apparently, one person said he had somehow was maybe on stilts also, so he appeared to be 9 feet tall. He's wearing clown shoes. It's a fantastic, completely outlandish outfit. And did a lot of, he was a juggler. He did a lot of, one could tell from the musical, pratfalls. And in this one, he sort of dances a kind of a cakewalk, which links him with Gollywog's Cakewalk and Minstrels, that kind of thing, which Debussy liked, obviously, very much. This is full of things like that. It's wonderful. And there are sort of wah-wah effects, obviously meant to suggest sliding trombones, and then... Now here's a quote from the Camptown Strutters Ball. One can miss it if you don't know that it's there, but it's his transposition of that. And then there are wonderful moments where it seems like he's going for some great sentimental climax. And a wonderful moment at the end where after this, goes into the wrong key. Love that D major. And then wakes up. For a nice roundup at the end.
So wonderful. Yeah.
So this is, again, coming after the sweet pastoral feeling of the Bruyère. And right after this comes perhaps the most profound piece and the most poetic of all of the preludes, and that's the one with the very evocative title, The Terrace of the Audiences of the Moonlight. It's a phrase that Debussy apparently found in a newspaper article about the coronation of George V in India. And it described the palace and described, can I just look at this? Because this is really quite beautiful to see how he just picked this phrase out.
Tell us again, the book is called Images, and who is it?
Images by the piano music of Claude Debussy by Paul Roberts.
Paul Roberts. It is an interesting way to phrase the title. Instead of the audiences on the terrace looking at the moon or something like that.
Well, the original thing was apparently the audiences Au Clair de la Lune. The terrace for moonlit audiences is the terrace of the audience of the moon. The phrase was in the journal, Le Temps, in December 1912. Debussy was struck by the phrase, given in French, the Hall of Victory, the Hall of Pleasure, the Garden of the Sultanas, the Terrace for Moonlit Audiences. So somehow that excited his imagination. That's all, I guess all one needs to know about, you know, the rest was up to Debussy to compose this marvelous piece, but he did use the moonlight. He said, begins the piece this way, say that the moonlight, which occurs after all, not only in Debussy's other pieces too, and the song Clair de Lune, based on Verlaine. But he lose Au Clair de Lune. Au Clair de la Lune, mon ami Perrault. Mon ami Perrault. So he uses the rhythm of that, transformed, which is, I think, again, very typical of the way the somewhat humorous and childlike mingles with this poetic other world, otherworldliness. And certainly, it's a beautiful way of representing the moonlight streaming down, very thin ray of moonlight. At least that's the way it seems to me. The piece, I think it's one of the gravest of these preludes. One of the richest harmonically and full of marvelous. Maybe more of a sense than any other prelude of the use of the extremes of the piano and the use of this marvelous open voicing, which may be more than anything any other composer Chopin used, you know. But the spacing of the chords has everything to do with the sound of the music. There's a very remarkable one at the one point, it comes to this. It's a very grave effect, don't you think? With this just really this kind of space.
And again, he has it on three staves to give you that feeling of three different layers. So it's not all in one dimension.
And that one wonderful thing at the end, but it becomes even slower, and he. This reminds me of the end of Afternoon Buffon, doesn't it? After. Yes.
You're listening to pianist Richard Good. He's performing tomorrow night at Davies Hall, a program of these Debussy Preludes, Book 2, Mozart, Brahms, and Bach. Thank you to Phil Perkins for engineering this interview. I'm Sarah Cahill. I think we forget sometimes how radical Debussy is because we think of him as this sort of impressionist composer with pretty pastel colors, but recently I played Leo Joyeux at one of his later pieces at a retirement home, and afterwards the announcer of the concert series said, an older woman, she said, well, it's not Clair de Lune. I got the feeling she really, it was way too modern for them. Yeah. But I think
it's
that's
also
a...
Loud.
It's very loud at the end.
That's the biggest, maybe the biggest, the Namaclamics and all the WC piano music. Mm-hmm. You shocked them.
Some louder than others, probably. But, I think people still do. Some people still think of Debussy as being the composer of Clair de Lune and not of these sort of revolutionary pieces, which they are, these late preludes.
Yeah. And even more, the etudes, which I have to admit, I don't, I've only little by little beginning to understand because they really take off. The late pieces like Je, the orchestral piece, which he was writing at this time, and the etudes. Do you know the etudes?
Yes, the etudes. Yes, and in fact, one of these preludes, the
Tierce Alternée,
is looking forward towards the etudes,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. The harmonic language is, I think a lot of it, Debussy was influenced by things like the gamelan. He was influenced by, he loved pentatonic scales.
American jazz.
American jazz, but I'm thinking of things that were not tonally centered and the things that didn't depend on directing the music, you know, the powerful, I think what Debussy, one of the things he was reacting against was the sort of powerful will-directed music of when he talked about Beethoven in sliding terms, which he liked to do. I'm sure there was a tremendous admiration behind it, but I think it was the sense of music which was discursive, logical, and powerfully kind of intention-driven. And I think that the music that he wrote, I think one of the great attractions of it is that it progresses and you don't quite know how it progresses. It has the dream progression. And I think that you see that also in Pelléas. And you see it in the motivations or mysterious lack of knowledge of their own motivations of the characters, or in a character like Melisande who seems to have no motivation. And I think some of the music that he wrote has that character. And that is, I think, revolutionary.
Did he keep track of what Schoenberg and other people were doing around the same time, and liberating tonality, and was he,
What did he think of Schoenberg? That's a good question. Schoenberg, I think when did Pierrot get written? Around the same time?
I think so.
I don't know. You never know, actually, from what a composer writes. You know that one of the admirers of Pierre Lenaire was Puccini. I always thought that was very interesting. And maybe Ravel, too. I don't know what Debussy thought of it. The next piece is Ondine, which seems like a perfect subject for Debussy, and it's wonderful to think that Ravel also wrote his Undine. But the two Undines are very different, and you've played, as I have not, the Ravel Undine. How would you describe that Undine as a character, if that were a character sketch?
Kind of malevolent. I think of his Undine, but the story is that she's under the water and she's seducing the sailor, mm-hmm. or the person on the land, the man, and actually trying to pull him underwater. That's the effect from the myth, right?
The poem.
That she's saying, come be with me in my kingdom under the water, but basically he's going to be drowned.
Yeah, she's sort of a Lorelei figure.
Oh, but in the Lorelei, yeah.
Well, kind of, you know, the siren.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Born of the water, but not a human soul. But the one that Debussy based his on, yours was a poem of
Bertrand.
And Debussy based his on a story by a treatment of the legend by a German romantic poet named Baron Friedrich Fouquet, de la Motte Fouquet, or something like that. And this was, I think, a gentler Undine. She was born in the water, and she was adopted. She came as a young girl. She appeared to this older fisherman's family, and as a beautiful young girl, beautifully dressed. There again, Arthur Rackham illustrated, and Debussy had the book, so maybe that was also inspired. She then grew up and fell in love with a knight, and married him, and was very happy. But she was not malevolent, but she had to go back to the water. She married in order to have a human soul, and she didn't quite have a human soul. And she eventually was called back to the water. I think the story ends tragically, but it seems like the Undine was not sinister, malevolent. In Debussy, it's very sensual and very sinuous, but also very fresh and kind of, it doesn't have this femme fatale, my lady Dietrich aspect. and it's interesting also because it's in a style of piece which I think of Debussy made his own, the slow scherzo. You know, it's one of the curiosities I think of Debussy's music, and maybe it has something to do with his ruthlessness sometimes of the harmony, is that he did not write much fast music. You know, I think it was harder to write a fast piece that way, unless they were perpetual mobile kind of pieces. So this is one of those rather leisurely scherzos with a lot of time for all kinds of digressions. And it begins like... Oh, yeah. Figure, you have both the brilliance of the water images marked scintillating, and then two gentle, so combined in one measure, so like a portrait, and then come. Yes, I have to admit that the title Ondine does enter every aspect of, at least for me, when I play it, it's absolutely impossible to not to think about water, not to think about the dual nature of this creature, not to think about the mysterious call back to the watery world. And for example, a passage like this. Fanfare, which appears all throughout the piece, and now the most evocative of the water music. I think also with Debussy, when he was in the conservatory, enjoying himself by playing parallel formations of fifths and octaves and all these nice things, and people telling him, "You can't do things like that." And he said, "Why not? I follow my own pleasure." And this kind of passage, yes, parallel formations of everything, and this wonderful passage, which. In which you hear this sort of, it feels to me like the distant horns with a second. So somehow very evocative of some kind of mysterious fate. Ripples. You know, another thing I feel, Debussy, I feel that for him the second was this interval of choice. Don't you feel so, he gets so much out of the second, the gentlest of dissonances, you know. He loves the second as much as Bartok loves the ninth, the ninth, but he uses it so much and to so many different effects, you know. It can be very harsh, but often it's this wonderful, I get so much out of
wonderful.
That.
And Ravel has that famous passage of seconds in his Ondine, where you have to play them with your thumb, chromatic seconds.
Yes,
and apparently he had very large, a friend said he had strangler's thumbs.
Strangler's?
They were so big and strong, so he could do those. He could play the seconds with his thumb.
He could, but I'm not sure that he could play the rest of the piece.
Yeah.
Do you know that story about Ravel was a pianist of some kind, but he wasn't very, Debussy really was a fine pianist. But Ravel, self-admitted, was not a terrifically good pianist. And that reminds me of a story about Schoenberg, who was a very bad string player. And when Louis Krasner, who was premiering the violin concerto, was complaining about the impossible things that Schoenberg had written, and Schoenberg said, "But I can play every single thing in that concerto." And Louis said, apparently, "Yes, master, but I have to do it all in a half hour." So maybe Ravel could do a second. So then, in our traversal of the second book, what breaks in on this, probably the most ethereal of all, and delicate of all the preludes, is this. Surprisingly, at least surprising to me before I started learning about Debussy, Dickens was one of Debussy's favorite authors. And Dickens was a very Anglophile. I mean, Debussy was very much of an Anglophile. He loved a lot of things that were English. And he particularly loved Dickens and valued him far above Thackeray and other people who were more fashionable at the time. His favorite novel was The Old Curiosity Shop. And he said he felt that Dickens was sort of the antidote for every ill. Made him feel good. He didn't have much English. He read him in French translation.
Is Dickens one of your favorite writers?
Yes. Yes. I have to say I haven't read Pickwick for a long time. But now I feel I don't have to because I play this prelude. So here you have the good, solid roast beef rendering of God Save the King in the bass with what I imagine is something like what Debussy might have mischievously harmonized it in his harmony class with funny chords. Slightly off. And then the very complacent, marked, amiable Mr. Pickwick. And then this ambling kind of theme, and very pompous stuff, the doings of the Pickwick Club, all very, very, and then when it rises to a wonderful climax at the end, in the middle, you have the ambling theme and God Save the Queen up in the top register. Collapsing back into amiability. And then from far off, Mr. Pickwick whistling a Scotch jig. And then more seriously. Very nice, but in context it's particularly nice, in between two of the more less solid and down-to-earth pieces. This precedes a piece called Canop, which is a sort of a study in stillness marked by my Debussy, very calm and sweetly, doucement, sad. And it begins in a certain way, you could say it's a little bit connected to the previous one, which had so many triads, but this begins with these parallel triads with a completely different mood, of course. And up was an Egyptian funerary urn. And Debussy apparently had one or maybe several of these objects. He was a great lover of art and a great lover of objects which inspired him. He probably might have told you the story about his wanting to have these things. And once the Hungarian, who was an American violinist named Hartmann, who wrote a fascinating, Arthur Hartmann, wrote a memoir of Debussy that was really very interesting. And he talks about how he met him and became a friend of his, and once brought him some very valuable and beautiful, he thought, antique cufflinks from a trip from Norway. He went to great trouble and expense to find these for Debussy, who knew loved beautiful things, and Debussy took one look at them, put them in his pocket, hardly thanked him at all, obviously didn't find them beautiful, and wasn't Debussy's way to be gracious. But in that visit to Hartmann's house, he got very excited, and he said, "There's something in your house I want." And Hartmann said, "Well, what do you think you want?" And Debussy took him to, showed him on a certain shelf was a little black rock of a very kind of volcanic rock, very shiny, of no value, but just rather beautiful. Debussy, "I want that." And Hartmann said, of course, take it." And Debussy was profuse in thanks. And the next time Hartmann visited Debussy's house, it was prominent on his desk, and he thanked Hartmann again very, very profusely and said it's an inspiration to him, this rock.
I would have asked for the cufflinks back.
I think Hartmann was enamored of Debussy. He would not have done such a thing. He put up with much worse than that. but this is one of the simplest of the pieces, and one of the strangest, perhaps. And I think two things about the Canope. One of them is that I think it shows more than any of the others the influence of Eastern music, and particularly gamelan music, in sounds like this. You can hear the gongs a little bit. End of this passage, this. It's very simple. And the other thing is, and this is so basic that it's true of so much music, but I think maybe particularly true of Debussy, who sets in the Prelude to the Afternoon of the Faun, he sets this chromatic melody of the flute in at least four different ways. First, unaccompanied melody is heard, and then you hear it with various accompaniments, each of which changes, of course, the color of it completely. But here you have, that's one setting, and then you have, and then at the end, when the piece has finally reached its C major close, I think somewhere Leonard Bernstein in his lectures on Answered Question talks about the melody as being sort of like the noun at which the harmony supplies the adjective. You could say that it's colored by each of these new settings in a way that the adjective might color a noun. But however it is, Debussy uses that very often, constantly, the changing meaning of a single note, for example.
You're listening to pianist Richard Good. We're here at the green room of Davies Hall, and tomorrow night, Monday, he's performing these Debussy Preludes Book 2 on the stage of Davies Symphony Hall, part of the San Francisco Performances Series. And thank you to Phil Perkins for engineering this interview. Thanks also to Jonathan Doff. We have a couple more to go, is
yes.
that true? Yes,
well, this maybe, that's right. Yeah. This sort of coda, where I think more virtuosic style, Debussy form of gentle virtuosity in the first one, which is the alternating thirds, the only one which doesn't have a picturesque title, and it's as good as its name. It consists entirely of thirds like this, but with a very delicate underlying melodic idea, and nothing at all rabble-rousing about this delicate. It's very grateful, actually. It's not easy, but it's mainly very, very delicate and refined kind of thing. Very rarely, no real climax, and with a very beautiful middle section of very suave. I have my own thought that maybe when Stravinsky, somewhere in the back of his mind, when he wrote Apollo, and particularly the Pas de Deux d'Apollo, which has so many thirds, it was maybe thinking of this piece. The harmonic language seems to me quite similar. White music, he calls it. And it links with the previous piece, which ends like this. And this piece begins with a little prelude that goes C major. So that's the link between the two pieces. And it's all entirely made up of thirds. And as you said, it points the way to the interval music of the etudes, which are thirds, octaves, fourths, and so forth, sixths, based on. And I've actually, it's interesting because this music is, again, it sharpens your ear for interval.
But this one doesn't seem like an etude to you.
It is an etude because it's a continuous pattern piece. Oh. But it's an etude like Chopin's etudes, which are not necessarily noisy, but are difficult.
Or exercise-like. Yeah.
No, not exercise-like. And then comes perhaps the most famous piece of the set, and justifiably the end of it, Fireworks, which is both fireworks pianistically and fireworks as a spectacle. And it begins with this whirring thing, which actually does link up with the last piece, because we've had interlocking thirds, whatever you like, and this begins with the thirds have turned into this whirring thing, off which the sparks come. Very difficult thing, very mean of Debussy to have you do this continuous thing and then have your hand fly off suddenly and try to play pianissimo at the other end of the keyboard.
Seems kind of treacherous.
It is treacherous. It's awful. Nothing can be done. You have to do it that way. People have tried to play this with one hand, but that's even more difficult. And here is where he unleashes also the possibilities of glissandi, some of which are absolutely, fantastically brilliant, but some of which are very gentle and pianissimo, which I can't do here. That kind of climactic one is certainly not gentle. And I don't know that there's so much to be said about this piece. It's a brilliant piece, maybe the most Liszt-ian piece, but I would say again, certainly not virtuosity for virtuosity's sake. It's transformed into something very poetic. And as we're talking about the uses of the seconds, there are passages like this. We both have the dissonant possibilities of the second and also the soft, wonderful things like this marked voluble. And then also the Petrushka aspect of the polytonals. Doesn't this sound like Petrushka?
Yes.
I think he must have heard it.
Interesting, because we began with one that sounds like Petrushka. Yeah.
And we end after a great pyrotechnics. We end at the end after the big everything dies down, and then there's this wonderful ending.
far off, the Marseillaise.
And this theme we've been hearing throughout. So he manages to combine not the two themes, the Marseillaise from far off. And another thing which Paul Roberts brings to our attention is that as the piece began with these two superimposed C and B flat, that is as the first prelude began with that, this piece ends with a D flat here. Later on here, but here, C major. So we have C major, and which turns to D flat. So we have, again, if we're talking about the piece as a unity, and you want to look at that way, you have the two tonalities superimposed at the end as at the beginning.
Beautiful.
Good composer.
Richard, thank you so much. We're looking forward to your concert tomorrow night at Davies Hall.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.